Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the No Silicast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever-so-slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, March 9th, 2008, and this is show number 139. Well, Steve and I are back from our romantic weekend away to Sedona, where we celebrated our 25th wedding anniversary with our two good friends, Dean and Suzanne. It was a complete blast. Everything I could have hoped for. We stayed at this fantastic bed and breakfast that we had stayed at 5 years ago with them, called Casa Sedona. It's positively idyllic. This whole area is just amazing. I mean, we hiked, we laughed, we ate, we laughed, we drank, we laughed. I mean, it was just fabulous. I just cannot see enough nice stuff about this weekend. It was just wonderful. The scenery is absolutely outstanding in Sedona. I don't know if you've ever seen these red rocks that they're always talking about there. It's just gorgeous. I took a panorama shot that I put in the show notes, so you can go take a look at it if you want to see what I'm talking about. It's truly extraordinary. I kind of like 5 years ago when we met Dean and Suzanne, they were an all PC house. Shortly after they met us, though, Dean went on a business trip where he was given a gift by his company. He was given an iPod. As of today, he now has, let's see, he has 7 iPods in the family. He's got a G5. He bought a MacBook for Suzanne, bought a MacBook Pro for his older daughter. He's fixing to buy a MacBook for his younger daughter. He talked to, I think it was his uncle, was it? He talked into getting a Mac, and now his next door neighbor has a Mac. So he's been spreading the Mac word, that's for sure. But it was kind of fun to watch. So he actually is a listener to the show, so I kind of have to watch what I say here and not spill the beans on everything that he does. Anyway, I have a great geek story, though, about the trip. So Steve and I land in Phoenix, right? And we rent a Nissan Altima. We hooked up the portable Garmin GPS and dialed in the hotel address. No sooner did we get on the freeway and we realized that this car had a stereo mini jack input. We, of course, had 2 iPods and an iPhone with us, so we were ready to hook up. And that was just when we realized that we didn't have a cable for it. Ah, come on, all this tech and we can't pull this off? iPhone to the rescue. I went to Google Maps, pushed the button for it to find my location using Wi-Fi and cell towers, right? So I'm in Google Maps. It shows our location pretty close, and then I hit search, and I asked it to search for Radio Shack. Down rained about 15 little red pins sprinkled across the map around us in Phoenix. Man, you would have thought I'd asked for Starbucks, there were so many of them. Anyway, so I click on the next one in our direction, and that was close to the freeway. I hit the directions button, and I had turn-by-turn directions ready for me right there. Well, there was one last thing I did need the iPhone for as well. We got close, but then we realized it was in some big mall. Well, hey, no worries. I clicked on the pin. The address and phone number pops up. I clicked on the phone number, and my little friend Ryan over at Radio Shack flew us in on how to find the Radio Shack in the mall. He even verified that we had the cable. He had the cable that we wanted. So we were able to listen to podcasts through our 2-hour drive and had a good time listening to the Mac Review Cast with Tim Verporten. So, I don't know. You know, we're geeks. We go on vacation. We bring all our toys. Well, let's dig into the show here anyway. We've had an ongoing special homework assignment to find someone in Antarctica to listen to the podcast. Looks like Michael might be able to crack this one for us finally. Here's his email. Allison, well, I may not be from Antarctica, but I'm headed down that way. I'll be turning 50 in just a few months now in June, and I have such a cool job that I've worked on every continent except one. I've played, visited, or worked in all 50 states now. So, for my 50th birthday, I decided to go to the one continent I've yet to go to. As a photographer, this will be a great opportunity. While I may not be able to listen to new podcasts during the journey, my iPod will definitely be along for the music. Oh, and the MacBook Pro will be along as well. Thanks for the interesting show, and keep up the nice work, Michael. Well, holy buckets, Michael, that's great! I can't wait to hear from you in June. Now, to have actually completed the assignment, I think that you need to take a picture of yourself in Antarctica with the NoSilicast logo showing on the screen. I put a picture in the show notes of my friend Dean playing the NoSilicast on his iPod Touch when we were at the top of one of our hikes, so you can see the kind of thing I expect of you. Thanks, Michael. Let us know how it goes, and love to see if you've got some cool pictures. Send those on over to us. Well, we have a lot of listeners and readers from Asia, too, but nobody has checked in from there in forever. I mean, I remember hearing from some people a long time ago, but, I mean, Asia's crowded with people listen to the NoSilicast. Well, it looks like listener Bruce can help us out with this. He sent in a great voice recording. Let's have a listen.
As always, we start with a problem that needs solving, which is you're driving in the car and you desperately want to call Allison and give her some feedback over the cell phone, but she doesn't have a call-in number. Answer, use a K7 number that you own and forward her the email. Hi, Allison. This is Bruce back in Kansas City after having spent a couple of days at a client site in Houston. And while I was driving around Houston, big wide area Houston, and it definitely is a lot of driving involved, I was listening to the podcast. I wanted to point out that I did listen to your podcast. In fact, I listened to 4 weeks worth of your podcasts while I was in Bangkok. So, Thailand being in Asia, if it's okay to retroactively have Asia checked off of your list, I wanted to call in and offer that to you. Love the show. Continue to listen to it, even though I don't own a Macintosh capable of booting OS X. Bye now.
Well, Bruce, I think that's awesome. I love the idea of someone being in Bangkok and listening to the show. Sorry about not having a call-in number, but do you know you're the very first person to ask me about that? Well, at least you were able to figure out how to make a recording for me. That was a lot of fun. I appreciate your email and and the recording, of course. So now it looks like the only A continent left in the current homework assignment is Africa. Now, who's up to the challenge? I can see from this month's Google Analytics that we've had hits from Algeria, Morocco, Senegal, the Ivory Coast, Ghana, South Africa, Egypt, and Tunisia. Come on, one of you folks write to me. What are you guys being so shy for? There's huge prizes. Like, you could hear your email actually read on the NoSillaCast. Instant fame. What would keep you from doing that? Come on, guys. Let's hear from you. All right, time for a little bit of software news here. I've talked about JAlbum, I think, about 238 times so far on the podcast. It's this great cross-platform web gallery software that no matter what web gallery software I come across, I try it out, I keep coming back to JAlbum. Well, last week, Carl from JAlbum.net wrote to me to let me know that they've released a new site for sharing of photo albums. This new site allows you as an end user, to create JAlbums and then publish them to the JAlbum site without having to have your own server. Now, I happen to have my own server, but I know a lot of people don't, so I thought that could be handy. They're also creating a community site where you can display albums that are hosted anywhere. This sounded cool to me because I have a habit, as I mentioned, trying out new web gallery software. I tend to sprinkle my web albums all over the web. I've got things in Flickr, I've got them in Picasa, I've got them on my own website, I've got them in .Mac. Hey, they could be just about anywhere. I'm not sure if you can link to albums actually created in different ways, though, so I went to JAlbum.net to test out that theory. I tried to create an account, but then realized I already had one. My albums that they're hosting on their site are at nosillacast.jalbum.net. Well, here's where things got a little bit weird. I had different experiences depending on whether I was in Firefox or in Safari. In Firefox, I can see that I had two albums up there, but in Safari, it says that there were none. Oddly, if I go to the albums page in Safari, it says that I have not added any albums yet. It also says I can add albums by clicking quote-unquote, add album by URL above. Well, that's exactly what I'm looking for, right? I want to add them by URL. Well, for the life of me, I can't find the button they're talking about. I took a screenshot of it just in case you guys can see it, because I can't. I'm hoping maybe Carl can point it out for me, because, you know what? It won't be the first time something really obvious escaped my eagle eye. So I also noticed that they didn't catch on to Leap Year, because they say I uploaded the album I did today. They show it, but they say that the date is the 10th of March, not the 9th. I'll give a shout out to Carl, asking him what's up with trying to link to albums that are hosted elsewhere, because I really want to be able to tell you guys about it. They only give you 30 megabytes free on the JAlbum site, so if you've got them already up someplace else, it would be really cool to just be able to link over them to them here. I'll let you know what Carl has to say. Well, last week I played a recording by Hannes from Austria, and at the end he had a little music playing. It was a song called Aperture Science. It was really cool. Well, I meant to ask him who I should give attribution to, but I forgot all about it, until I happened to hear it on another show in its entirety. It turns out it's by the artist Jonathan Colton, and you can get his music at jonathancolton.com. As always, there's a link in the show notes. Remember how in my whining about not being able to get Time Machine to run a backup for me, I also complained that my home folder is invisible? This has been bugging the daylights out of me. First, I noticed it when I was thinking it was a mistake in Time Machine because I couldn't, if I drilled over to the Time Machine hard drive, I couldn't see my home folder. And Bart and I thought, well, maybe that's part of the way Time Machine's supposed to work, so you don't go in and muck around with it. You only get to it through the Time Machine interface. But it was only happening to me, not to him. But then again, I installed the new Super Duper backup program, and I ran a backup, and again, I can't see my home folder on the backup. Well, finally, I noticed that my home folder is actually invisible on my computer's hard drive, too. I enlisted the help of Steve Stanger from the Mac Attack, and he knows every utility known to man or woman to clean up things in your computer and fix the little gremlins that seem to creep into our Macs. But he was stumped, too. Then this weekend, I got an email from Connor titled Home Folder MIA. Here's what he says. While pursuing this month's Macworld magazine, I found a fix that might help your home folder problem. This is the quote from the article. If you open the user's folder at the root level of your hard drive, you should see your home folder there. It's the one labeled with your account name. If it's missing after you upgrade to Leopard, don't panic. It's still there, just hiding. To make it visible again, launch Terminal, that's in application/utilities, and enter the following term. chflags, that's one word, space, no hidden, space, and a tilde. It says, don't forget the space tilde at the end. Hope this helps. If it does, you can thank Ted Landau. Connor. Well, Connor and Ted Landau, that did the trick. My home folder is back, and I'm a happy little camper. Thank you so much for sending this. That was driving me bonkers. Doesn't really matter because I actually had my home folder over in the sidebar, but it just bugged me. Why was it not there? Where did it go? So I really appreciate taking the time to send that in, Connor. And Ted Landau, wherever you are, thanks a lot. Well, it's time for a word from our sponsor, Honda Bob, that colorful character who's been maintaining my Hondas and Acuras for the last 30 years. By the way, you should notice that I'm very careful to say maintaining and not fixing my cars, because we hardly ever have to call them for repairs. I think it's a combination of well-made automobiles with excellent service by Honda Bob. Just imagine not having to go to some icky dealer or some stinky garage where you never know who's going to work on your car, and you're sitting there wondering, ooh, am I going to get an idiot or a thief this time? Oh, please let it just be a thief. Anyway, that's the way I figure people think. If you live in the LA or Orange County area, you could instead sit back in your Barca lounger and watch a ball game or putter in your garden or play on your computer while Honda Bob comes to your house and works on your cars. He only does Hondas and Acuras, so don't even think about asking if he'll work on your Toyota. If you're interested in having his tender, loving care on your cars, give him a call at 562-531-2321 or shoot him an email over at hdabob@aol.com. HDA Bob's mobile service is not affiliated with Honda, Acura, or Honda Worldwide. As you undoubtedly know, video screencasts are all the rage. If a picture is worth 1,000 words, then a video must be worth 1,000,000, I guess. Well, I'm not a big fan of like your talking head podcasts, but if I can see how to follow a few steps in a video, that's way better. At work, I've been creating video screencasts with Camtasia Studio from TechSmith.com. This program is utterly fantastic, and I want to tell you about it. In Camtasia Studio, I can define the size of the window ahead of time, which works really well in Windows. I'm making 800 by 600 videos of Excel, so I made a desktop background with an 800 by 600 black rectangle on it. That way I can slap my Excel window on, size it to 800 by 600, and now I can create the podcast or the video cast at 800 by 600, full resolution, and I know everything I've got is going to be in that window. Now, the reason I say that whole idea of capturing just a window works good on Windows, it's because in Windows, your menu bar is stuck to the top of the window you're working in. I thought that was kind of dopey at first, but it turns out if you're on a Mac, it wouldn't really work to capture just a window because you'd have your Excel window nicely sized at 800 by 600, but every time you tried to go get a menu pick, nobody's going to see what you're picking. So anyway, I hate to admit it, but I think that Microsoft's way of doing menus might be a bit more intelligent. Well, anyway, when you're doing the recording, you can record the screen, the audio, and video on three separate tracks. You can choose any one of these three or a combination. I like to start my videos with a black screen and the name of my podcast on the left. I call it Tech Tips with Allison. And I let the video record me just for the introduction. Like I said, I don't like talking head videos in general, but I think it adds a little bit of personalization at the beginning that people like. Plus, you get to see how dorky I look with a headset microphone on while I'm doing it. Anyway, I shut the video off as soon as I jump into the application so I'm not too annoying. I try to make self-deprecating remarks at the beginning too, you know, like what a dork I look like with my headset mic on. Camtasia Studio actually has several separate programs. There's a recorder, then the editor is where you lay down your clips, pretty much like you would audio in GarageBand. There's an audio-only recorder and a few others that I can't really remember. The big ones I use are the recorder and the editor. Once you do a recording, it gives you a preview, and then it offers to let you make another recording or go right into editing. The editing is very intuitive and fun. Again, a lot like GarageBand. You can select a region and clip it with scissors, make the audio louder or quieter by 25%, which turns out is really, really useful. A couple of times I've made recordings on two separate days, and the audio is just completely different volumes, but I could grab the one that's too low and just go louder, louder, louder. It worked perfectly. I was really happy with it. The really fun part starts if you add callouts to your videos. You can choose from arrows, speech bubbles, subtle gray banners, all kinds of great choices. I like to throw in a call out to explain, for example, when I'm hitting a key. Like, for example, if I'm going to bring up a menu and I want to say that I control click to do it, you kind of need to say that on screen because people can't actually see what you're pushing with your keyboard. You can edit the duration of the callouts simply by dragging the left and right sides back and forth on the timeline, and you can slide them right and left too. Of course, you have full control in the callouts of the fonts, the size of the callout, colors, everything you'd want to do with it. It's very slick. I like to watch the Lab Rats video podcast from labrats.tv, and they do a bunch of really funny callouts making fun of each other. So I took that idea and I applied it to my Excel videos. You can imagine how dry an Excel tutorial can be, so you gotta spice it up. While producing a video from your recordings in Camtasia Studio is a bit tricky, but only because they give you so many options. They have some presets like iPod Video, WMV, or AVI, and if you stuck to those, you probably wouldn't be too confused, but you know how I like to get in and fiddle with the details. For example, 800 by 600 was not an option, so I made my own preset. In there, you can define size, quality, bitrate, sample rate, audio bitrate, sample rates, encoding format. You can go crazy with this stuff, and of course, I did. Another powerful and important feature of Camtasia Studio is the ability to add closed captions. These show up if you produce your video in Flash, perhaps in other formats too, I'm not sure. Closed captions are important because they give the hearing impaired a way to actually read instead of listen. Hey, you might be sitting in a cubicle and you don't have headphones, so it'd be nice to be able to read along too. Can come in very handy. I know I read them at the gym sometimes when I'm not listening on my headphones. So here's the problem. You have to type out everything you said. That's boring. But anyway, then you slap it into a text window in Camtasia. When you first do that, the entire text will be red, except for the first three lines, which will be black. You hit play on the video, and as soon as you hear yourself say the beginning of the next three lines, you click a button. It takes only the length of time it takes you to play the movie. All of your captions are marked to right where you said those sentences. Could not be easier. But I really should mention again how incredibly annoying it is to type out what you've said. As you know, I type out my script ahead of time, but that's like a free-flowing stream of consciousness process while I'm typing. Typing it after the fact is tedious beyond your imagination. You have to keep flipping back and forth between the video and your text editor hitting play, pause, flip windows, type, flip windows, hit play, pause. Oh, it's gruesome, I tell you. Perhaps if I talked slower or typed faster, I could keep up. But as it is, it takes me probably eight times as long as the video takes just to type it out. Thank goodness I'm keeping my longest screencast to 8 minutes. I've experimented with Vista's voice recognition to see if I could make it do the heavy lifting typing for me, but it was comically bad at it. I mean like 95% failure rate, not even close. So for now I'm doing it by hand, but man, do I dread it. Maybe it's worth buying Dragon Naturally Speaking to try to do it. Anyway, Camtasia Studio isn't cheap at $300, but it is incredibly powerful. Their website is great, too, because they have all of their tutorials as screencasts. Betsy from TechSmith told me at Macworld that TechSmith is working on a Mac version of Camtasia Studio, which would be awesome. I sent a little note off to TechSmith on Saturday begging to get involved in any beta testing, so hopefully I'll find out a bit more about their progress sometime soon. In the meantime, you can settle down and test out Jing from TechSmith. They do have a Mac version and a Windows version, so that's a lot of fun too. Well, I've also used Snapseed Pro for the Mac to try to make screencasts, but it's really primitive in comparison. It has not been upgraded in forever. It's only $70 from AmbrosiaSW.com, but it lacks all of the editing features of Camtasia Studio. It doesn't let you do audio and video as separate tracks, doesn't let you have picture-in-picture video from your camera, doesn't give you call-outs, doesn't give you captions, and it doesn't have the export options of Camtasia Studio. It does do screen capturing, which is cool, but I've got a lot of free utilities to do that. The newest entrant into this market for the Mac is ScreenFlow from VaraSoftware.com. That's V-A-R-A Software.com. I wasn't sure what to expect, but I was sure hoping for something more along the lines of Camtasia Studio. ScreenFlow starts out with one distinctive difference from the other two. It captures the entire screen, period. It seems a bit restrictive, but we'll see how much this design choice actually limits us. They do give you options of zooming into the front window during your post-production, but I didn't get too far into that. ScreenFlow opens with what Merlin Mann seems to like to call a heads-up display, or a HUD, which is his phrase for the dimmed, translucent gray windows that are all the rage these days. I'm not sure I like them, but I guess they're okay. The menu defaults to allowing you to record video, audio, and computer audio along with your screencast. The two different audio options confused me at first until I realized the distinction was me yapping versus the programs on the computer making noise, like if you had, iTunes playing a song at the same time. One warning here, I gotta tell you, when you bring up the ScreenFlow Helper application, when you first pop it up, if you have the video recording turned on, this thing will go crazy on just your processors are just going to go nuts until you close that settings window, because it actually brings your camera up on screen. I ran a quick test of recording with all three on, and I liked the result. The audio and video came in as one track, which is probably good, because it would be silly to be able to get them out of sync. Luckily, you can still add separate audio and video actions to the timeline, so you get the best of both worlds. One thing ScreenFlow has above Camtasia Studio is in the sizing of the picture-in-picture video for screencasts. With Camtasia Studio, you pretty much have to define it ahead of time, and it stays in one place. On ScreenFlow, you can simply drag the corner of the video in order to change its size, or you can actually move it from side to the side of the screen if you clip it and things like that. I mentioned that when you record a video of your talking head, it makes the audio and video track stick together. When you record your screen and audio at the same time, it puts them on separate tracks. This is an excellent design decision because it's pretty common to mess up your audio when you're trying to demonstrate an application at the same time. You know, imagine you're trying to poke and move menus around and stuff. How often do you think you'd screw up what you're trying to say at the same time? Well, since those are on separate tracks, you could re-record a section and drop it in place as long as you were careful on timing. You know, it could all work out. You could still have the screen shot going, but your voice could be dropped in on top in the right places. I tested to make sure you could drop in new audio, and it could not have been easier and more intuitive. I went over to the media bin, and at the bottom I saw Add Recording. I clicked that, and a window came up offering to record from my desktop, meaning another screen recording, or video from my iSight, or audio from my built-in mic. It even offered to record the computer audio again. I made a little recording, and it dropped right into the media bin so I could move it about in the timeline. The existing audio timeline was easy to work with, too. I moved the slider to one point and found Split Clip, moved it to another, split it there, and then I deleted that middle clip and I dropped in the new one. Piece o' cake. It's even similar to GarageBand in that Command-T is how you split a clip in GarageBand, and Command-Shift-T is how you split clips in ScreenFlow. Very nicely done. ScreenFlow requires Leopard, and I think we may be starting to see the advantages that people have been talking about that Leopard brings under the hood. In GarageBand, when you move the magnification slider to improve granularity, It jumps to the position you've chosen and expands it. In ScreenFlow, you get the same kind of slider, but as you drag it along the timeline, it modifies very, very smoothly. A bunch of the visuals were just really smooth and sexy. I do wish I could shrink up the screen recording to improve what I could see in the timeline, though. I ended up with 3 tracks, but I couldn't see them all at once because it was too short. I mean, like in height, since there were 3, I couldn't shrink up the window up above and make more room for it down below. I could only scroll up and down to see what I wanted. I'd improve that there. Maybe it's because I'm an audio person mostly, but it bothered me that I couldn't see the waveform for the audio, or at least I didn't find it in the menus how to do it. There is a pretty little audio icon with a gray bar along the timeline, but that's all you can see about the audio. If you're allowed to see the waveform like you can in Camtasia Studio, it's much easier to find the exact point at which you actually belched. When you really get into audio, you can tell what certain sounds look like, certain things that you say. So if there's something you want to cut, you can find it much more easily and you can find those cut points. If you watch your own audio long enough, you can recognize a laugh or an outburst as though it were a photograph. ScreenFlow does not seem to have an option to view it, but I hope I'm wrong and they write back to me and say, "You dork, it's right here." Well, ScreenFlow does have callouts, but they're nothing at all like the ones in Camtasia Studio. As I mentioned, in Camtasia Studio, you can add speech bubbles, gray bars, arrows, all different directions of them, and all kinds of options to make a point on top of the screen. In ScreenFlow, a callout means something completely different. If you add a callout action, it dims the entire screen except for a circle around your cursor. You can modify these callouts a lot, changing the diameter, the fade-in, fade-out time. You can add a border that's even got color around it. You can add feathering. It's a really nice tool. I don't want to say that's wrong. I mean, that's definitely a cool thing. But I'd really like to be able to add different types of callouts, especially, like I said, being able to show on screen what keystroke I'm using in the application, because that's the one thing you cannot show on screen. I'd rather not have to buy yet another application to do that after the fact. I made a couple of little screencasts, and I messed around with them. Then I realized that I could show you what ScreenFlow looks like. Well, with ScreenFlow. How weird is that? It actually let me record itself. Anyway, in messing around, I discovered that I could actually split the eyesight track, the one showing my talking head, and then move the talking head around the screen so I would actually jump around on the screen. How's that for a way to annoy your audience? Hey, but it could be handy, because if your talking head was covering up a menu you're pointing at, you might want to move it. Better yet, how about not having the talking head? I told you how I feel about that, didn't I? Well, anyway, the first time I tried to export from ScreenFlow, it crashed, which made me a bit grumpy, as Bart would say. But the second time, it actually worked. My screen is at 1440 by 900, so when I exported it at half that size, 720 by 450, I thought that would be a pretty good resolution. I left all the video and audio settings alone, exactly as it came. I was not at all happy with the output, though. The text was very fuzzy and basically unreadable. That doesn't make any sense with a screencast. So I went in and I changed some settings. I set the compressor quality to high from, I think it was on good to start with. I changed the encoding to multipass, which gives you better quality. I let the data rate be automatic instead of restricting it to a low number. And I kept the compression type at H.264. While I was in there, I also changed the audio to mono. I'm only one person, guys. Why would you need stereo? And I downgraded the audio to my normal 64 kilobits per second from their default setting of 96. That actually shrank my short video from 15 megabytes down to 7 megabytes. And guess what? It looked exactly the same as the first time I did it. Well, I tried encoding it at full resolution, but with their settings, which would make a huge file, certainly, took way, way, way longer. Not double. I mean, like, I don't know, 5 or 6 times as long. I was worried about how big the file might become when I did that. Remember, I had about a 15 megabyte file with their settings. It came out at 57 megabytes. So the good news is the file was crystal clear and sharp, looked really, really good. But man, that was huge. Well, I also tried to make it a normal HD size, choosing 720 pixels tall, which would make it 1152 wide to maintain the 1.6 aspect ratio of my screen. But there was a little bug in ScreenFlow because it kept changing it to 960 by 720. I thought I was going nuts. I did it 3 separate times and it kept coming out that way. I ended up all squished looking, you know, thinner because it had squished the 1152 down to 960, which, you know, that was good, but I still look kind of goofy. I ended up having to quit ScreenFlow and go back in to get it to pay attention to the custom size I was giving it. Oh well, this is a first release, so I'm not too upset by that. It did look pretty good at 1150 by 720 in the end. I put a link in the show notes to my final product. It's really short and it's kind of goofy, but it does kind of show you a little bit of what the interface looks like too. Overall, I give ScreenFlow a B+. It's really, really easy to use and get comfortable in. It's a snap to get started, and it has some cool features like the callouts on the cursor. I found it intuitive to split tracks and edit independently, and I like the way you could move the video around on screen and change its size. A couple of things I wish it had was callouts for text on screen. I wish I could record just one area of the screen so I could keep that at high resolution. They definitely need to allow you to see your waveform if it's not hidden in a menu somewhere. And I think they should add a way to add closed captions. Even though they're annoying to do, we got to include everybody in this party, you know? For the $100 price tag, I think it's well worth the price, especially compared to our only other option on the Mac, which is SnapZ Pro.
Hi folks, this is Bart from BartBush.ie, back again on the No Silly Cast. Since Alison's decided that her wedding anniversary is apparently more important than chit-chat across the pond, well, she probably has a point. Anyway, I've decided to send in a pre-recorded segment this week rather than doing our usual chit-chat. So I have two things to talk about this week. I'm going to be keeping it short because I'm still suffering quite a bit from a chest infection, and simply going up and down the stairs leaves me out of breath, so talking isn't really particularly good, and I'm going to be pausing this thing 101 times to stop and cough my lungs up. Anyway, so, first thing I want to talk about is a little update to an app I absolutely love, and it's called SoundSource. It's a freebie from the nice people at Rogue Amiga Software. This app doesn't do very much, but what it does very well. It's a menu bar app, so it provides a little icon on your menu bar that looks like a pair of headphones, and when you click on it, it allows you to specify the which of your sound devices to use for output, input, system sounds, and also to open the sound preferences and to open the MIDI setup from within the menu bar drop-down, which is nice and handy. Now, this new version does all that, and it adds one other feature which I have to say is exceptionally cool. It gives you sliders for each of those volumes straight within the menu bar. This is a new Leopard-only feature because now in Leopard we can have complicated UI inputs within menus. So you couldn't do this in Tiger, therefore this new feature clearly can't work in Tiger. Anyway, I just thought I'd mention it. It's a nice little update to a nice little free app. All in all, I think it's tiny. It's less than a megabyte in size. And the links and stuff are in my blog post, which I'm hoping Alison is going to link in the show notes. Okay, so on to the main topic of what I want to talk about today. And since this is the NoSillaCast, how's about we start with a problem statement? Let's say that you have a web app that you really like to use. So you have it open in your web browser, and you're using that web app to do something creative. Maybe you're using Gmail to write an email. Maybe you're using your company's webmail to write an email. Maybe you're using some sort of web-based image editor. Who knows what it could be? Some form of web-based something. And you're trying to go over and back to another app where you're copying and pasting and then you're going back across. If you're using a normal desktop app, you would, of course, move around by using Apple Tab. And so you'd Apple Tab across, select what you want, Apple C, Apple Tab back, Apple V to paste it in. But if you're stuck in a web browser, the chances are that you can't do that because I very often need to get stuff off the web. So then I'm in one tab for the app and I'm in a different tab for what I'm getting from, and if I try to Apple Tab across, it doesn't work because I'm in the browser for both and my head hurts and it generally isn't nice. So basically I don't like having applications somehow imprisoned within my web browser. So that's the problem that Fluid sets out to solve. Now, from my point of view, there's three advantages of what Fluid allows you to do. First is that it liberates your web app so that they show up in the dock. Secondly, it allows you to Apple Tab to them. And thirdly, it allows you to define a space for them to go into. I'm a huge fan of spaces, and I'm very picky about assigning apps to different spaces so that, you know, they go there automatically and stuff. I'm a heavy user of spaces, despite its obvious flaws. Okay, so how does Fluid help? Well, what Fluid does is it allows you to create a custom web browser that will only serve you up the one site that it's designed to represent or to proxy or to wrap, I suppose is probably the best term. It's sort of a wrapper for that website. So it uses the WebKit engine, i.e. the back end of Safari, to actually do the rendering. So if you can imagine that it's as if you were to go to the page with Safari, take a scalpel and cut out the page that is the web app, and then stick that into an entirely new application you've just made, which has its own dock icon, its own name, etc. And that's what Fluid does. So use Fluid to make apps. So you never run Fluid, you run the apps you make with Fluid. It's a little confusing, but it works. So you fire up Fluid, and it gives you a prompt for some pieces of information. First thing it asks you is the URL for the web tool that you're trying to create a little wrapper for. Second thing it asks you is the name you'd like your application to have. And the third thing it asks you for is where you would like to save the new application you're about to generate. Then finally, you can specify an image file to use as the icon for the new application you're about to create. Or the default option is that it will use the website's favicon, or if the website is particularly advanced and modern, it will use the iPhone icon that the website has set to become the icon for the application. So you enter this information, hit go, and the new application is generated, and then you launch that application like any other application. It'll just pop up in a window, the web page you're expecting to see will be there, do all the usual stuff. What there won't be is back buttons and forward buttons and all the other web browser paraphernalia. That's all gone. You just see that particular web app there on its own, in a window on its own. You can Apple tab to it, you can assign that new app to different spaces, it'll show up in the dock. For all intents and purposes, you've liberated the web app from the web. Those of you using Gmail may say, this sounds awfully familiar. There's a very nice app called Mailplane that lets you do exactly this kind of thing for Gmail. But Mailplane is for Gmail only. And Mailplane is an awful lot more advanced than Fluid because it lets you attach attachments by dragging and dropping them onto Mailplane and stuff. So Mailplane isn't a general purpose, you know, web app de-webifier, for want of a better term. It's highly targeted towards just Gmail. And if you're expecting Mailplane level of sophistication from Fluid, you're going to be disappointed because Fluid is a generic app. It works with any page, so it can't do those kind of highly specific things. It does have another flaw, which I bumped into while trying to set up a Fluid app for Twitter. Fluid tries to be smart, and in so doing does the typical Microsoft thing and ends up being rather dumb. When you go to a URL that's in a different domain to the one that the web app or the Fluid app was created for, Fluid assumes that it's an external link, and therefore it doesn't open the link in Fluid, it opens the link in your default web browser, because that's what would happen if a third-party standalone app were to present you with a link which you clicked on. So I use Fluid to create an interface to my work webmail, and that's exactly the behavior I want. So if I get an email into my work webmail, which I've set up as a Fluid app, I go into the Fluid app, log into my webmail, open the email, click on a link from, say, Allison or someone, and it pops up in my default browser, just like it would have done with a standalone desktop mail app. That's good. However, some apps, Flickr in particular, break Fluid because they don't stay in their domain. When you go to Flickr and you go to log in, you don't log in to Flickr. Flickr redirects you to Yahoo, which is where you log in. So as soon as you click the login button on a Flickr app that you've made with Fluid, up will pop your default web browser and the login page will be there because it's in a different domain, so Fluid thinks it's an external link. So there's absolutely no way to log into a Flickr app that you make with Fluid, at least not that I've been able to find. So there's a flaw. However, for everything else I've used it for, it works just fine. And I have been using it a fair bit, sometimes just purely to experiment, but I do actually use it for real for my webmail for my ISP and for my work webmail. Basically, it's a small, simple, and free app, so, you know, why not? I have to say it's quite a good thing. If you're a big addict to things like Facebook and MySpace and that kind of thing, this is absolutely perfect because it allows you to get MySpace out of the web browser and into a thing of its own. I don't do that kind of stuff, so why don't use it for that? But apparently it's very good for that. Anyway, I'm going to leave it there for now, mainly because my chest is absolutely killing me after talking for this long. I hope you found this interesting, and hopefully by next week I'll be over this bloody chest infection. I hope Alison will have had a great time on her anniversary, and hopefully we'll be back to a chit-chat across the pond as usual. Until next time, happy computing.
There is just something about the way Bart explains things that I always understand things better if he's the one explaining it to me. I've tried SoundSource, I don't know, at least 4 or 5 times, and I keep looking at it going, what is F4? I don't get it. I don't understand. But after listening to Bard, I threw Sound Source up in my menu bar, and now I realize that I can get to my sound control panel so much faster, and I have to mess around in there all the time with making all the recordings I do. I also took a shot at making a little Fluid application, and I'm not exactly sure all the places I could use it, but I just tried it like on Version Tracker, and to be able to have that, let's say you wanted to go there all the time, to have it as a separate application that you could Apple Tab to or have in a separate space, that sounded pretty cool. I thought it was neat, and I want to thank Bart, and I did put the links to his blog for both the Fluid explanation and Sound Source. Well, it sure is nice to be home, but if you ever get a chance to visit Sedona, I sure do recommend it. You gotta go out there. It's such a beautiful place. I want to thank everyone for the well wishes on our anniversary. It really means a lot to both Steve and I. Keep up all the great email feedback, too, by sending your comments, suggestions, and reviews to Allison@podfeet.com. Thanks for listening, and stay subscribed.